What's up, folks? Hope everybody's doing well. I'll tell you about my guest in just a minute. I am outside recording this. I needed to get outside. Plus, I've been outside working. I put in a small brick patio for a fire pit, and it really sucked. I got to be honest with you. I mean, I have COVID, and I didn't think anything could suck more than having COVID, and I was wrong. Putting bricks in 90-degree weather with COVID is probably the dumbest thing a person could do. It's for a fire pit, and the ironic thing is when I light the fire, I can't even smell it because I can't smell. I can't taste anything because of COVID. So, which gets me to thinking, if there's a fire in the house and I'm asleep, I'm pretty much a dead man because I'm going to sleep right through it because I can't smell it. And what I suggest is if you want to build a small fire pit, go online and search for fireplace videos and just watch a fireplace video in your air-conditioned home because it's way better than doing what I did. I'd invite you over, but I have COVID and you don't want to hear me complain about not being able to taste anything because even my dog is at this point going, just can you leave for a little while? Because you're really annoying. Anyway, my guest this week, Jacob Soboroff, NBC News and MSNBC correspondent who has a great new book out, really interesting about the separation of migrant families under the Trump administration. We talk about that and he's done a lot of research on it, written a book about it, and it's got really astounding things to reveal that a lot of us didn't realize, at least I didn't. So I think you're really going to enjoy it. Got YouTube videos going, youtube.com/PaulMercurio. Follow me on the social media, all that good stuff. I don't want to bore you with that. Enjoy Jacob Soboroff and I'm going to sit here and watch my patio dry. I got to get a life. Very excited to have on my next guest who's been on the show before, NBC News and MSNBC correspondent, Jacob Soboroff. Jacob, great to have you back on the show. You were on with Katie Tour to talk about your special American Swamp, and I really have always enjoyed and admired your work as a reporter and really enjoyed talking to you about the special. And so I was excited to see you have a new book out, wanted to talk to you again. So great to have you on again.
Thanks, Paul. It's great to be back with you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. So you have this book out. It's a New York Times bestseller, Separated, Inside an American Tragedy. It's an important book. I mean, it really, and I can't overuse that word enough, it reveals really the truth behind the Trump administration's separation of migrant families at the U.S.-Mexican border. And I say it's important for many reasons, one being that this story is not over, although it feels like it is because we haven't heard much about it, and there's been so much other stuff going on, obviously COVID and everything else. And reading up on this a bit and why the book, you said, because you were covering this crisis, really, you were one of the frontline people, one of the first people to really drill down on this. But you said in covering it that what I was left with was, even though I saw this horror with my own eyes, how did this happen? How could this happen in the United States of America? And so that prompted you to write the book. And where did that question then take you?
That's exactly why I did write the book, is that, I saw all of this with my own eyes, right? The kids being detained in cages at the McAllen Border Patrol Processing Center, under Mylar blankets and supervised by security contractors in a watchtower. I'll never forget it, as long as I live, going into the former Walmart, 250,000 square feet as well in Brownsville, and wearing the kids were allowed outside 2 hours a day, 1,500 boys, hundreds that had been separated. And I just knew it was something that had changed me immediately and will stay with me forever. But I could not comprehend, despite the fact, that I covered this pretty extensively, that our government was doing this to children on our soil and in our name. And so I started you know, basically back where I began at my notes from those days and talking to people who I got to know over that time period. And what I learned was this was a preventable tragedy. It was something that at multiple key inflection points, career civil servants and dedicated child welfare specialists and experts had pushed back against the Trump administration. And despite their best efforts, the administration moved forward. And so you can read about in a book, like whether it was within HHS or ICE or the Office of Refugee Resettlement, there were people taking a firm stand inside the government. And I didn't know that at the time. I just thought it was one big cluster, frankly. And while it wasn't for lack of trying on behalf of people that cared very greatly about these children, who now will be left with a century of suffering.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much that's so important and great in the book. I mean, you talk about it, what I really like about it is how honest you are about the whole tragedy, everybody, including yourself. I mean, you take yourself to task a little bit saying you didn't see it. You said in 2016, there were warning signs all along. They were going to do something about catch and release and undocumented immigrants. It was imminent and didn't really see it. And you talk about seeing Stephen Miller making a speech and just thinking, I think the quote is, who the fuck is this dude? And like,
yes,
just going batshit crazy. And in 2016, I think like a lot of us, you thought, well, this isn't really going to turn into anything. These people are just crazy. And how did we miss it? Like, what's your take on that?
I can tell you how I missed it. I didn't take it seriously enough. You know, like I looked at Stephen Miller in that ballroom. I said what you said that night, you know, who the fuck is this dude? And I went on Rachel Maddow that night. You know, we kind of joked that it was just a disaster in that Colorado ballroom and at the Colorado convention where I think they got skunked by Ted Cruz. You know, he got no delegates. Cruz got them all that night. And then at the conventions, I thought, you know, even then, like the way this guy is talking, it cannot be real. It cannot be serious. He's saying he's going to end catch and release, so-called catch and release. What does that even mean? You know? And then he becomes president. And I should have known, particularly because of the way that he talked about Mexicans from day one coming down the escalator, the rapists and criminals. And then there we go. You know, they hit the ground running. And I write about in the book on Valentine's Day, 2017, as early as just a couple weeks after they had taken office, they start to talk about implementing family separations. People walk out of that meeting shell-shocked, I write, because this was something that was considered during the Obama administration and considered not only as a policy, but considered by so many as off limits. It was a third rail. They'd never touch it. Who would?
Right.
The Trump administration is the answer.
Well, first of all, I think I can call you a friend now. I've talked to you a couple of times. Let yourself off the hook. You let yourself off the hook. We've all been saying, this can't possibly happen. This can't possibly, I mean, you know, you make a good point that this had actually been going on for a year before, quietly, before it had been formalized or made public by the administration, which was in 2018, right?
I mean, they on a very limited basis for the safety of the children that were coming, the Obama administration would separate parents and children. And I'm talking about relative to the Trump administration, virtually nobody. I mean, a handful, but enough that the Department of Office of Refugee Resettlement started keeping an informal spreadsheet. When the Trump administration came in, all of a sudden, John Kelly said they were going to do it. They secretly started doing it in the El Paso sector. The Houston Chronicle, Lomi Creel, and then Caitlin Dickerson from the New York Times exposed it in bombshell reporting. And then once the spring and summer of 2018 rolled around, this thing had burst into the public view. But you're absolutely right. It was secretly in development after the administration sort of backed off after the initial backlash in 2017 when John Kelly had admitted they were considering it. But they never stopped. They never stopped, and they still haven't stopped, by the way. You know, there's children as we speak who are at risk of separation ahead of a deadline on the 27th of July. So, you know, even the idea that the president signed the executive order ending the policy, that wasn't the end of the policy. It just changed the way that they approach separations.
Right. And the thing too is in June of 2018, it came out that the policy didn't even include any plan or measures to reunite the families that had separated. It was just this big
cluster. And that's what I was referring to, you know. And you can read about all the different ways that the Trump administration was warned. But you're correct. At multiple twists and turns, officials said, this is going to traumatize children. We don't have the technology to reunite children. If we do this now, this is going to be a spectacular disaster. And they went forward with it anyway.
Right. The book just, you know, I thought I kind of knew in a general way, fairly well informed about what was going on. But then in reading the book, there's so much more to this in terms of how it happened, what went on, timelines, like June 20th, the president signs an executive order ending it. June 26th, Judge Sabra issues a preliminary injunction. And then the Trump administration just continues to separate people after both of those events. Like, it just goes on and on and on.
And you know, now what I know is that he never wanted to stop, right? He said he didn't like it because of the sights and the sounds, the pictures, the images, the reporting, the activism around it.
Right.
But in early 2019, aboard Marine One, and I write about this in the epilogue, he looks over at Kirstjen Nielsen as they're going to console victims of a tornado, many of whom had family members who had died, and said, we got to reinstitute that. And she said, sir, I don't think I can do that on my own. And Melania Trump said, we can't do that. We can't do that. And Trump says, we'll see. We'll see. It never was something that left him as what he thought was an effective policy on the border. And that's the fact, you know. The idea they backed off from this was an illusion. And that's something else that I learned.
Yeah, there were two examples that stand out as end runs that they were trying to make. One was, correct me if I'm wrong, July of 2018, given the preliminary injunction, that they were forcing migrants to choose between leaving the country with or without their kids, right? Like, basically preventing them from asking for asylum, right?
Correct. And Juan and Jose, the father and son I write about in the book, were faced with that exact choice. And
right.
Were it not for a lawyer who won the right back to reunify with his son, that might have happened to them. 400-plus parents were deported without their kids. And today, that's the current legal battle, that they're going to try to separate kids, present them with the binary choice of either separation or indefinite detention or deportation together. You know, they're trying to put only horrific choices in front of people coming here that want to seek asylum. I mean, that is an international right, an international, internationally legally recognized right. And the Trump administration continues to push back on multiple fronts. And, you know, this separation is only one type of that. And that's why lawyers will tell you that, you know, arguably it's kind of worse today than it was back then. Although I'm sure that the 5,500 parents and kids would tell you there's no way that there's anything worse than being taken from your family.
Right. Well, the other great thing about the book is that it's a lot of facts that you thought that you didn't know, embellishment of facts that you did, and also real examples, heart-wrenching examples that really bring home the effect of the policy, like Juan and Jose. I know those aren't their real names, but they basically were seeking asylum from Guatemala, correct?
Yeah, exactly, and you know, it was what I think is particularly sad about their story. Well, every story. I mean, every one of the, I say in the book, every one of the 5,500 stories is unique. I mean, they're similar, but they're all unique. And they were fleeing for their lives. They were threatened by narco violence in Petén, Guatemala, and decided to leave behind their wife, mother, and sisters, daughters, to come here. And nobody takes that risk because they want to. You know, I've been to Guatemala, talked to people who have come. You don't leave because you leave because you must, not because you want to. Nobody wants to leave their home. When you walk around where I was in the central part of Guatemala in the dry corridor, nobody will tell you they want to leave. Everybody says they want to leave because there's some extenuating circumstance that makes it necessary. Generally, it's literally survival from poverty, malnutrition, starvation in the most extreme circumstances in the drought-stricken parts of Central America, violence, of course. And that's what they faced too. And when they got here and they got to the border and they jumped over in Arizona, they wanted to turn themselves into the Border Patrol. They didn't want to run. They wanted to tell them they were there for safety. And the first thing that happened to them was they were bled into different cells in the Yuma Border Patrol station and didn't see each other again for nearly 5 months.
Yeah. And you're right about home. No matter how bad your home, quote, neighborhood is, it's still your home. Like, there is a heart connect, an emotional connection to a place. So if you have to leave, then you really have to leave. And as I'm reading the book and sort of learning more, I'm getting more and more angry at the Trump administration because they just will not give up. In August of 2019, they tried to end the Flores settlement agreement, right? And explain to folks what that is and sort of why.
Well,
they
continue to. The Flores settlement agreement is what they've long wanted to end. They thought family separation would end it. In fact, the Obama administration wanted to end it. It requires the children being detained on the border be released after 20 days from ICE detention. And they've always thought that if they could do that, it would scare people from coming to the country. They thought the same thing about family separation. The Obama administration thought the same thing about deportations. The Bush administration thought the same thing about a massive expansion of the Border Patrol. The Clinton administration thought the same thing about building the first wave of border walls. Deterrence as a policy, and that's what ending the Flores settlement agreement would be, which means you can get out after 20 days, is deterrence never works. The idea of scaring people with detention, with death, with separation, it's never stopped people from coming, and they're continuing to come. So the idea that we think punishment is the solution to immigration, it's well documented that it's not the case. It's well documented that it doesn't work. And so that's why you got to look at the root causes of why people come. And that's what I said, desperation. That's why, you know, it's much more effective to go and look at where people are coming from and why than trying to stop them when they get here, because it just doesn't work.
And it's an excellent point, because when you look at how cruel these quote unquote deterrent measures are and people still come, that informs you as to how bad their situation is, right?
Correct.
It is the lesser of two very, very, very bad
evils.
You'll
make one of the most dangerous journeys on planet Earth through Mexico, cartel-held territory, because it's a walk in Central Park, as I think President Trump once called it.
Yeah. Is this Stephen Miller getting into his head and pushing this agenda, or is Stephen Miller his henchman in this, you think?
You know, I don't know. You'd have to ask them. But it's well documented that Stephen Miller has had his hands all over this, including in a big dump of documents that came out yesterday, actually last night. Miller has long pushed for this type of stuff. He obviously was supervising this extraordinarily closely. And his own now wife, then the spokeswoman for the Department of Homeland Security, was intimately involved. I write about her quite a bit in the family separation policy. Katie Miller, then Katie Waldman, who not only let me into these facilities, but did so wanting us to see the cruelty, believing that it would further the immigration agenda of the administration.
It's just unbelievable. I mean, were there any unknowns or misconceptions you had based on your coverage as a correspondent up to that point, as you started to research the book and go into your notes and delve into this to write the book? Were there any unknowns or unknowns that got corrected, or misconceptions cleared up, or new things that you learned that you didn't know before going into writing the book?
I think the big one for me was that I thought there was no plan to reunite. And as I mentioned to you earlier, there indeed was a plan. And throughout the book, I write about how people tried to plan to save these children. And the administration and the political specifically continued to push back. And were it not for these dedicated career civil servants, this could have been arguably far worse. 30,000 children may have been separated is the number that I use in the book. And it ended up being 5,500, at least until this day. So for me, it was a bright spot in reporting on a very, very dark chapter in American history, one of the most shameful in modern American history, for sure. That there are people inside that care, and they tried to stop this government from doing what they did, and unfortunately, they weren't successful.
Did I read this right? But an Amnesty International report said that between April of 2018 and August of 2018. 6,000 family units have been separated just between those several months. Is that
yeah.
number right?
Yes, family units is the way that they define parents and children together. So that's right. That tracks exactly with the number that the government put out. You know, they generally put out the number of children. If you think 5,500 children total have been separated, you know, you got two parents for many of those children, it's a very believable number.
Yeah. So we don't know where this is now. We don't know how this is going to end. I think you said it's about 5,400 kids to date, children to date, sort of separated or families affected by this. What do you, is it only with getting Trump out of office that this thing gets corrected in some way, or what is your gut on where this goes?
No, I don't think it is. As a matter of fact, I think Biden in office still requires an extreme level of oversight with regard to immigration policy. Obama and Biden built the facilities where the children were caged. You know, and that's the reality. While they didn't systematically separate the thousands of children, the infrastructure was there because of them. And so do I think that there'll be a change in the posture of the Democratic Party? I do, based on the primaries and the way people are now talking about things like defunding or abolishing ICE. You know, do I think that's going to happen? I'm not sure. But what's happening on the streets of Portland right now with the Border Patrol agents out there, I mean, I'm seeing mainstream Democrats talk about immigration enforcement and dialing it back in a way that I don't think we ever have, at least in this generation of American politics. Right.
Well, you know, there's other things going on too. Like, you know, as of March of 2020, GAO issued a report that the arrests of families with the kids under 18 as part of the family grew from 22% on the Southwest border apprehension in 2016 to 51% in the first two quarters of 2019. So there are other ways that they're sort of implementing this quote unquote deterrence, this cruel plan, that are really negatively affecting these families as well, right?
Yeah. And that, look, again, that's why I wanted to write this book. If we don't wake up and see who's caught in the crosshairs of the immigration enforcement system, especially on the border, it's going to keep happening. And that's the message. Separated to me means as much about the physical act as it does our mental separation from the reality of what's going on. And so I just hope that when people read the book, when they see the details of how we got here, how the policy happened, it's going to change the way that we talk about this and we think about this.
I think so. I mean, I really took a lot away from reading the book. It's really, as I said at the beginning, it's important. Everyone should go get it, read it. It's a New York Times bestseller, Separated, Inside an American Tragedy, Jacob Soveroff. Really great, great work. And you just do terrific reporting. It's always great to have you on. Come back anytime, talk about whatever you want. It's always, always terrific to talk to you.
Paul, I appreciate it, my friend. Thank you.
That was Jacob Soveroff. Really glad to have him on again. Hope you enjoyed it and found it interesting. I am still watching my new brick patio, fire pit patio dry. Go to youtube.com/PaulMercurio. Got some videos there that we've been posting, and a lot of stuff on my social media pages at Paul Mercurio. Always posting stuff every day. Please follow, tell your friends about the podcast, and actually go and give it a review on iTunes if you like it. If you don't, then just keep your mouth shut, please. All right. Hope you guys have a great week. Stay safe. Wear a mask, for God's sake. Thanks.